to Short Story Thursdays. SST presents Crane, week number 253. I'm recording this in my new apartment in Los Angeles. Not that anybody gives a shit. So maybe the acoustics are good because there's nothing in here. I'm sitting on my kitchen floor. But you won't be able to hear the acoustics because I'm still using my travel mic. So sorry about that. But the story's called An Experiment in Misery. So I can relate. Let's jump in. Opening quote here. This is also the second dispatch I've done drunk. The other one was prior to leaving when I was in a rush, I guess, to get drunk and also to leave. But again, I'm on vodka today. Okay. Opening quote from the story. He was going forth to eat as the wanderer may eat and sleep as the homeless sleep. Dear sweet readers, Crane, as in Stephen Crane, as in the author of the book, The Red Badge of Courage, which is a book I haven't read. But I deserve a red badge of courage, or some goddamn badge anyways, for dragging my idiot ass across Asia, only to wash up on the dirty, frothy shores of sunny Los Angeles, California. The story is called An Experiment in Misery, and haha, oh shit, that sounds like a succinct description of my high school career. And it's the perfect complement to last week's story by Jerome K. Jerome, wherein he gets on everyone's ass about doing something in the world. All the people bustling down the street, guaranteeing everyone that if you just try to do something, the effort alone will be the reward. Shut your mouth, Jerome. Let's take a look at Crane's world through the eyes of one boy walking down a crowded street, god-awful poor. What's he supposed to do, Jerome? The boy is crushed. Sad little buddy can find no escape from the watery soups and disgusting flop houses that make up his everyday life. This story is so vividly composed, I suggest you get a shower running prior to reading. Maybe even put a hearty meal on, because by the end, you'll be affected. You'll smell the complicated breath of the hobo sleeping next to you, feel the glassy sheen of an unwashed body. I've been flopping all over these days, sheened up by the 90-plus heat of Hong Kong, searching for a clean bed. I'm on a blow-up mattress right now. Clean meal and a clean mind, none of which I found. But I'm here now in L.A., and the streets are clean, but my mind certainly isn't. So I love this story. Little kid is getting the worst of it from a town that don't care. What about him, Jerome? Tell me. What about this kid? This kid is fucked. But the story is gorgeous. Please read it. It's perfectly amazing. When you lift your eyes from the last line, I promise you, the world around you, it will shine by comparison. Then shower and eat something, you filthy hobo. And keep this little guy in your heart all week. He's day by daying it out there. Day by daying it, the little tyke. It is my duty and sick honor to bestow upon him the red badge of poverty. Oh, SST bullet point number one. I'm in a terrible, dark mood. Or maybe I'm just scared. Finding a new home is scary, right? It is. Don't tell me it ain't. Whoops. Sorry, I'm lashing out hobo style. Don't touch my can of beans. Them's mine, goddammit. I should take a shower. Bullet point number two. I write this dispatch north of Compton, south of Beverly Hills, east of the pretty ocean I haven't seen yet, staying with a great friend whom I affectionately call the Gypsy, even though she has a two-bedroom home here, which is not at all Gypsy-like, but, you know, she didn't choose her nickname. I did, for various reasons which meant something, and that's that. If you're out there and you've chosen your own nickname, that's not your nickname. Your nickname is Asshole. There. Now you've got a real one. Bullet point number three. After I find an apartment done, the first step is finding a new home for SST Bar Shift out here in L.A. Research, guys. It's all about meticulous and inebriating research. But the second step is getting our SST shirts up for sale online. We have the shirts. We have the photos of the shirts. I just need to assemble the puzzle. But it's hard to assemble puzzles when your hands are shaky with fear and you have no home. And the final bullet point, number four here. I hope you love this week's story, because I really do. And if you do, a Crane collection is for sale below. Actually, you can get that at www.shortstorythursdays.com/books, and you can support what I'm doing here by buying a paperback, a beautiful paperback. So shortstorythursdays.com/books, containing not only this week's selection, but a Crane story we've featured in the past. All right, I've done them twice, along with like 17 other stories I bet are wonderful. And this week, the collection is also available in ebook format as well as paperback. So if your boxcar contains a plug and charger, you can read her electronic. See you next week. Thanks for being my friend. For the homeless, friends are clutch. Okay, I'm excited to read this story because it's more miserable than my misery. So that'll be a nice bit of sunshine. Stephen Crane is the author. An Experiment in Misery. It was published in 1894, SST number 253. It was late at night, and a fine rain was swirling softly down, causing the pavements to glisten with hue of steel and blue and yellow in the rays of innumerable lights. A youth was trudging slowly, without enthusiasm, with his hands buried deep in his trouser pockets, toward the downtown places where beds can be hired for coppers. He was clothed in an aged and tattered suit, and his derby was a marvel of dust-colored crown and torn rim. He was going forth to eat as the wanderer may eat and sleep as the homeless sleep. By the time he had reached City Hall Park, he was so completely plastered with yells of bum and hobo that with various unholy epithets that small boy had applied to him at intervals, that he was in a state of the most profound dejection. The sifting rain saturated the old velvet collar of his overcoat, and as the wet cloth pressed against his neck, he felt that there no longer could be pleasure in life. He looked about him, searching for an outcast of highest degree, that they too might share miseries, but the lights threw a quivering glare over rows and circles of deserted branches and glistened damply, showing patches of wet sod beneath them. It seemed that their usual freights had fled on this night to better things. There were only squads of well-dressed Brooklyn people who swarmed towards the bridge. The young man loitered about for a time and then went shuffling off down Park Row. In the sudden descent in style of dress of the crowd, he felt relief, as if it were he who were now at last in his own country. He began to see tatters that matched his tatters. In Catham Square were the aimless men strewn in front of saloons and lodging houses, standing sadly, patiently, reminding one vaguely of the attitudes of chickens in a storm. He aligned himself with these men and turned slowly to occupy himself with the flowing life of the great street. I'm going to take a sip of my drink to Brooklyn. Though in the mists of cold and storming night, the cable cars went in silent procession, great affairs shining with red and brass, moving with formidable power, calm and irresistible, dangerful and gloomy, breaking silence only by the loud, fierce cry of the gong. Two rivers of people swarmed along the sidewalks, spattered with black mud, which made each shoe leave a scar-like impression. Overhead, elevated trains with the shrill grinding of the wheels stopped at the station, which upon its leg-like pillars seemed to resemble some monstrous kind of crab squatting over the street. The quick, fat puffings of the engine could be heard. Down in an alley, there were somber curtains of purple and black on which street lamps dully glittered like embroidered flowers. A saloon stood with a voracious air on a corner. A sign leaned against the front of the doorpost that announced, "Free hot soup tonight." The swing doors, snapping to and fro like ravenous lips, made gratified smacks as the saloon gorged itself with plump men eating with astounding and endless appetite, smiling in some indescribable manner as the men came from all directions like sacrifices to a heathenish superstition. Caught by the delectable sign, the young Moll allowed himself to be swallowed. I think that's a typo in the story itself. The young Moll allowed himself to be swallowed. A bartender placed a schooner of dark and pretentious beer on the bar. Its monumental form upreared until froth atop was above the crown of the young man's brown derby. "Soup over there, gents," said the bartender affably. A little yellow man in rags and the youth grasped their schooners and went with speed toward a lunch counter where a man with oily but imposing whiskers ladled genially from a kettle until he had furnished his two mendicants with a soup that was steaming hot and in which there were little floating suggestions of chicken. The young man, sipping his broth, felt the cordiality expressed by the warmth of the mixture, and he beamed at the man with oily but imposing whiskers who was presiding like a priest behind an altar. "Have some more, gents?" he inquired of the two sorry figures before him. The little yellow man accepted with a swift gesture, but the youth shook his head and went out, following a man whose wondrous seediness promised that he would have knowledge of cheap lodging houses. On the sidewalk, he accosted the seedy man. Say, do you know a cheap place to sleep? The other hesitated for a time, gazing sideways. Finally, he nodded in the direction of the street. I sleep up there, he said, when I've got the price. How much? 10 cents. The young man shook his head dolefully. That's too rich for me. At that moment, there approached the two a reeling man in strange garments. His head was a fuddle of bushy hair and whiskers from which his eyes peered with a guilty slant. In a close scrutiny, it was possible to distinguish the cruel lines of a mouth which looked as if its lips had just closed with satisfaction over some tender and piteous morsel. He appeared like an assassin steeped in crimes performed awkwardly. But at this time, his voice was tuned to the coaxing key of an affectionate puppy. He looked at the men with wheedling eyes and began to sing a melody for charity. Say, gents, can you give a poor fellow a couple of cents to get to bed? I got 5 and I got to get another 2 before it gets me a bed. Now on the square, gents, can you just give me 2 cents to get a bed? Now you know how a respectable gentleman feels when he's down his luck and I... The seedy man, staring with imperturbable countenance at a train which clattered overhead, interrupted in an expressionless voice. Ah, go to hell. But the youth spoke to the prayerful assassin in tones of astonishment and inquiry. Say, you must be crazy. Why don't you strike somebody that looks as if they had money? The assassin, tottering about on his uncertain legs and at intervals brushing imaginary obstacles from before his nose, entered into a long explanation of the psychology of the situation. It was so profound that it was unintelligible. When he exhausted this subject, the young man said to him, "Let's see the 5 cents." The assassin wore an expression of drunken woe at this sentence, filled with suspicion of him. With a deeply pained air, he began to fumble in his clothing, his red hands trembling. Presently, he announced in a voice of bitter grief, as if it had been betrayed, "There's only 4. "4," said the young man thoughtfully. "Well, looky here, I'm a stranger here, and if you steer me towards a cheap joint, I'll find the other 3. 4, said the young man, thought, oh, wait, I lost my place. I'm going to sip my drink. This is fucking bullshit, man. You guys deserve better. It's just, I got no help, you know, and it's just me doing this, so it's just me in this lonely room." The assassin's countenance became instantly radiant with joy. His whiskers quivered with the wealth of his alleged emotions. He seized the young man's hand on the transport of delight and friendliness. "By God," he cried, "if you'll do that, by God, I say you was a damn good fellow, I would, and I remember you all my life. I would, by God, and if I ever got a chance, I'd return the compliment." He spoke with drunken dignity. "By God, I'd treat you right, I would, and always remember you." The young man drew back, looking at the assassin coldly. "Oh, that's all right," he said. "You just show me the joint. That's all you've got to do." The assassin, gesticulating gratitude, led the young man along a dark street. Finally, he stopped before a little dusty door. He raised his hands impressively. "Look here," he said, and there was a thrill of deep and ancient wisdom upon his face. "I brought you here, and that's my part, ain't it? If that don't suit you, you needn't get mad at me, yeah? You won't get no bad feeling, will there?" "No," said the young man. The assassin waved his arms tragically and led the march up the steep stairway. On the way, the young man furnished the assassin with 3 pennies. At the top, a man with benevolent spectacles looked at them through a hole in the board. He collected their money, wrote some names on a register, and speedily was leading the 2 men along a gloom-shrouded corridor. Here we go. Shortly after the beginning of this journey, the young man felt his liver turn white, for from the dark and secret places of the building, there suddenly came to his nostrils strange and unspeakable odors that assailed him like malignant diseases with wings. They seemed to be from human bodies closely packed in dens, the exhalations from 100 pairs of reeking lips, the fumes from 1,000 bygone debauches, the expression of 1,000 present miseries. A man, naked save for a little snuff-colored undershirt, was parading sleepily along the corridor. He rubbed his eyes and, giving vent to a prodigious yawn, demanded to be told the time. 1:30. The man yawned again. He opened a door, and for the moment his form was outlined against a black, opaque interior. To this door came 3 men, and it was again he who opened the unholy doors, and it rushed out odor like fiends so that the young man was obliged to struggle as against an overpowering wind. It was some time before the youth's eyes were good in the intense gloom within, but the man with benevolent spectacles led him skillfully, passing but a moment, to deposit the limp assassin upon a cot. He took the youth to a cot that lay tranquilly by the window, and showing him a tall locker for his clothes that stood near the head with the ominous air of a tombstone, left him. The youth sat on his cot and peered about him. There was a gas jet in a distant part of the room that burned a small, flickering, orange-hued flame. It caused vast masses of tumbled shadows in all parts of the place, save where, immediately about it, there was a little gray haze. As the young man's eyes became used to the darkness, he could see upon the cots that thickly littered the floor the forms of men sprawled out, lying in death-like silence, or heaving and snoring with tremendous effort, like stabbed fish. The youth locked his derby and his shoes in the mummy case near him, and then lay down with an old and familiar coat around his shoulders. A blanket he handled gingerly, drawing it over part of the coat. The cot was covered with leather and as cold as melting snow. The youth was obliged to shiver for some time on this affair, which was like a slab. Presently, however, his chill gave him peace, and during this period of leisure from it, he turned his head to stare at his friend, the assassin, whom he could dimly discern where he had sprawled out on a cot in the abandon of a man filled with drink. He was snoring with incredible vigor. His wet hair and beard dimly glistened, and his inflamed nose shone with subdued luster like a red light in the fog. Gatsby. Within reach of the youth's hand was one who lay with yellow breast and shoulders bare to the cold drought. One arm hung over the side of the cot, and the fingers lay full upon the wet cement floor of the room. Beneath the inky brows could be seen the eyes of the man, exposed by the partly open lids. To the youth, it seemed that he and this corpse-like being were exchanging a prolonged stare, and that the other threatened with his eyes. He drew back, watching his neighbor from the shadows of his blanket edge. The man did not move once through the night, but lay in the stillness, as of death, like a body stretched out expectant of the surgeon's knife. And all through the room could be seen the tawny hues of naked flesh, limbs thrust into the darkness, projecting beyond the cots, upreared knees, arms hanging long and thin over the cot edges. For the most part, they were statuesque, carven, dead. With the curious lockers standing all about like tombstones, there was a strange effect of a graveyard where the bodies were merely flung. Yet occasionally could be seen limbs wildly tossing in fantastic nightmare gestures accompanied by guttural cries, grunts, oaths. And there was one fellow, off in a gloomy corner, who in his dreams was oppressed by some frightful calamity, for of a sudden he began to utter long wails that went almost like yells from a hound, echoing wailfully and weird through his chill space of tombstones where the men lay like the dead. The sound, in its high, piercing beginnings that dwindled to final melancholy moans, expressed a red and grim tragedy of the unfathomable possibilities of the man's dreams. But to the youth, these were not merely the shrieks of a vision-pierced man. They were an utterance of the meaning of the room and its occupants. It was to him the protest of the wretch who feels the touch of the imperturbable granite wheels and who then cries with an impersonal eloquence, with a strength not from him, giving voice to the wail of the whole section, a class, a people. This, weaving into the young man's brain and mingling with his views of the vast and somber shadows that, like mighty black fingers curled along the naked bodies, made the young man so that he did not sleep, but lay carving the biographies for these men from his meager experience. At times, the fellow in the corner howled in his writhing agony of his imaginations. Experiment in Misery, this one's called. Finally, a long lance point of gray light shot through the dusty panes of the window. Well, we've all felt that. Without, the young man could see roofs drearily white in the dawning. The point of light yellowed and grew brighter until the golden rays of the morning sun came in bravely and strong. They touched with radiant color the form of a small fat man who snored in stuttering fashion. His round and shiny bald head glowed suddenly with the valor of a decoration. He sat up, blinked at the sun, swore fretfully, and pulled his blanket over the ornamental splendors of his head. The youth contentedly watched this row of the shadows before the bright spears of the sun, and presently he slumbered. When he awoke, he heard the voice of the assassin raised in valiant curses. Putting up his head, he perceived his comrade seated on the side of the cot, engaged in scratching his neck with long fingernails that rasped like flies. "Holy gee, this is a new breed. They got can openers on their feet," he continued in a violent tirade. The young man hastily unlocked his closet and took out his shoes and hat. As he sat on the side of the cot lacing his shoes, he glanced about and saw that daylight had made the room comparatively commonplace and uninteresting. The men, whose faces seemed stolid, serene, or absent, were engaged in dressing, while a great crackle of bantering conversation arose. A few were parading in unconcerned nakedness. Here and there were a man of brawn whose skin shone clear and ruddy. They took splendid poses, standing massively like chiefs. When they had dressed in their ungainly garments, there was an extraordinary change. They then showed bumps and deficiencies of all kind. There were others who exhibited many deformities. Shoulders were slanting, humped, pulled this way and pulled that. And notable among these latter men was the little fat man who refused to allow his head to be glorified. His pudgy form, built like a pear, bustled to and fro while he swore in fishwife fashion. It appeared that some article of his apparel had vanished. The young man had tired himself speedily and went to his friend, the assassin. At first, the latter looked dazed at the sight of the youth. This face seemed to be appealing to him through the cloud wastes of his memory. He scratched his neck and reflected. At last, he grinned, a broad smile gradually spreading until his countenance was round illumination. "Hello, Willie," he cried. That's the dude's name. "Hello," said the young man. "Are you ready to fly?" "Sure," said the assassin, and he tied his shoes carefully with some twine. When he reached the street, the young man experienced no sudden relief from unholy atmospheres. He had forgotten all about them, and he'd been breathing naturally and with no sensation of discomfort or distress. He was thinking of these things as he walked along the street when he was suddenly startled by feeling the assassin's hand trembling with excitement, clutching his arm, and when the assassin spoke, his voice went into quavers from a supreme agitation. "I'll be holy bloomin' blowed if I wasn't a fellow with a nightshirt up there on that joint." That was terrible. The youth was bewildered for a moment, but presently he turned to smile indulgently at the assassin's humor. "Oh, you're a damn liar. They're talking about whether or not there was a guy with a fucking ghost white nightshirt. Obviously there wasn't, because it was a fucking flop house." "You're a damn liar," he merely said, whereupon the assassin began to gesture extravagantly and take oath by strange gods. He frantically placed himself at the mercy of remarkable fates if her tale were not true. "Yes, he did. I crossed my heart 1,000 times, he protested, and at that moment his eyes were enlarged with amazement, his mouth wrinkled in unnatural glee. "Yes, sir, a nightshirt, a holy white nightshirt." "You lie." "No, sir. I hope to die before I can get another ball if that wasn't a jay with a homey, blooming white nightshirt." His face was filled with infinite wonder of it. A holy white nightshirt. I assume that's holy. It's spelled H-U-L-L-Y, but I assume it's supposed to be a holy white nightshirt. A holy, but, I mean, I'm just going to say it. A holy white nightshirt, he continually repeated. The young man saw the dark entrance to a basement restaurant. There was a sign which read, "No mystery about our hash," and there were other age-stained and world-battered legends which told him that the place was within his means. He stopped before it and spoke to the assassin. "I guess I'll get something to eat." At this, the assassin, for some reason, appeared to be quite embarrassed. He gazed at the seductive front of the eating place for a moment, then he stared slowly up to the street. "Well, goodbye, Willie," he said bravely. For an instant, the youth studied the departing figure. Then he called out, "Hold on a minute." As they came together, he spoke in a certain fierce way, as if he feared that the other would think him to be charitable. "Looky here, if you want to get some breakfast, I'll lend you the 3 cents to do with it. But say, looky here, you got to get out and hustle. I ain't going to support you. I'll go broke before midnight. I ain't no millionaire." "I take me oath, Willie," said the assassin earnestly. "The only thing I really needs is a ball. I assume a ball is a drink. The only thing I really needs is a ball. My throat feels like a frying pan. But as I can get a ball, why, the next best thing is breakfast. And if you do that for me, by God, I'd say it was your rightest boy I ever see." They spent a few moments in dexterous exchanges of phrases in which the East protested that the other was, as the assassin had originally said, a respectable gentleman. And they concluded with mutual assurances that they were the souls of intelligence and virtue. Then they went into the restaurant. There was a long counter dimly lighted from the hidden sources. Two or three men in soiled aprons rushed here and there. The youth bought a bowl of coffee for 2 cents and a roll for 1 cent. The assassin purchased the same. The bowls were webbed with brown seams, and the tin spoons wore an air of having emerged from the first pyramid. Upon them were black, moss-like crustaceans of the age, and they were bent and scarred from the attacks of long-forgotten teeth. But over the repast, the wanderers waxed warm and mellow. The assassin grew affable as the hot mixture went soothingly down his parched throat, and the young man felt courage flow in his veins. I'm just going to take a sip. Memories began to throng in on the assassin, and he brought forth long tales, intricate, incoherent, delivered with the chattering swiftness as from an old woman. Great job out in Orange. Boss, keep you hustling, though, all the time. I was there 3 days, and then I went to ask him to lend me a dollar. Go to the devil, he says, and I lose my job. Yeah, I used to work in Little Torito, rafting logs, making $2 or $3 a day in the spring, lived high, cold as ice, though, in winter. I was raised in northern New York. Oh, yeah, I was just ought to live there. No beer, nay whiskey, though, way off in the woods. But all the good hot grub you can eat. By God, I hung around there as long as I could till the old man fired me. Get the hell out of here, you worthless skunk. Get the hell out of here and go die, he says. You're a hell of a father, I says. You are, and I quit him. And then they were passing through the dim eating place. They encountered an old man who was trying to steal forth with a tiny package of food, but a tall man with an abominable mustache stood dragon fashion barring the way of escape. They heard the old man raise a plaintive protest. Ah, you always want to know what I take out. You never see that I usually bring a package in here from my place of business. As the wanderers trudged slowly along Park Row, the assassin began to expand and glow blithe. Blithe. By God, we've been living like kings, he said, smacking appreciative lifts. Look out, or we'll have to pay for it tonight, said the youth with gloomy warning. But the assassin refused to turn his gaze towards the future. He went with a limping step into which he injected a suggestion of lamb-like gambols. His mouth was wreathed in a red grin. Coming up on the ending here. Right where they started. In City Hall Park, the two wanderers sat down into the little circle of benches sanctified by traditions of their class. They huddled in their old garments, slumberously conscious of the march of hours, which for them had no meaning. The people of the street, hurrying hither and thither, made a blend of black figures, changing yet frieze-like. They walked in their good clothes as upon important missions, giving no gaze to the two wanderers seated upon the benches. They expressed to the young man his infinite distance from all he valued. Social position, comfort, the pleasures of living, were unconquerable kingdoms. He felt a sudden awe. And in the background, a multitude of buildings of pitiless hues and sternly high were to him emblematic of a nation forcing its regal head into the clouds, throwing no downward glances. In the sublimity of I'm going to read this whole fucking paragraph again. I'm going to start over. And in the background, a multitude of buildings of pitiless hues and sternly high were to him emblematic of a nation forcing its regal head into clouds, throwing no downward glances, in the sublimity of its aspirations, ignoring the wretches who may flounder at its feet. The roar of the city in his ears was to him the confusion of strange tongues, babbling heedlessly. It was the clink of the coin, the voice of the city's hopes, which were to him no hopes. He confessed himself an outcast, and his eyes from under the lowered rim of his hat began to glance guiltily, wearing the criminal expression that comes with certain convictions. Cold wind blowing, guys. Cold fucking wind.